of our speakers from the week. We have Jeremy with his seminar, if you want any clarification about anything he said. We have David, Andrea, and Annette with their relationship seminar. Paul from the Leadership and Personality Seminar. And then Tony with any of his talks. So if you have any questions, this is the time to ask. We do have a few people that wrote down questions, and we'll get to those as well. But right now, does anybody have any questions for any of them? Josh.
You're talking about, like, divorce, and the only reason for being able to divorce is marital faithfulness. And I was wondering, like, is that only physical, or could that be in other areas of life as well? So my aunt was married, but she got caught up in pornography, and they struggled with it for a long time, and then after a while, she's like, okay, well, and they went and had kids because of it and all sorts of stuff like that. And so ended up, she wanted to get divorced. They went to the church, got counseling, and they said, no, you can't. But I was like, so I guess it seemed kind of like, I wasn't sure, like, if that could be considered marital unfaithfulness, because he was...
Can I take a shot at that?
Yeah, I want Jeremy to take that one.
We're all, for the most part, Presbyterian here, right? PCA.
Yeah.
Our denomination has spoken to this. There's really actually two biblical reasons. One would be adultery. The other one would be desertion. Okay? All my spouse is unbelieving. Spouse leaves, they're free. No longer bound. Our denomination, while not with the authority of Scripture, has addressed this in a position paper. And essentially, Jesus wanted to set the bar for adultery very high. Okay? And so if you look at Matthew 5, the Sermon on the Mount, he says, if you've looked at a woman, what? With lust in your heart, with lustful intent, you've committed adultery. So by that definition, by that definition, then every single married man has committed adultery. And therefore, if that was the bar, then every wife would have grounds, biblical grounds for divorce. So we don't want to lower that bar. Jesus intended to raise that bar. There's a couple of words, porneia, where we get pornography and stuff. The idea of adultery is not simply, a gentleman in my church recently had an emotional affair with a coworker. I don't want to introduce, you guys stop me if this is too inappropriate. Guy in my church came to the elders because he had not crossed any physical lines, but certainly he was treating this other woman with this sort of affection and, saying things to her that he only should have said to his wife. They were like soulmates, kind of, he felt. That was what we would kind of call it, that emotional adultery. But even then, I don't think that meets the biblical definition of what Jesus intended, because divorce is... while permissible, never advisable. That would be my take. Do you guys agree?
I agree.
Okay, good.
I mean, I have one story to kind of follow up on that. I had a coworker who went through a divorce. He had been, his wife was a believer, he wasn't. He had gotten really caught up in pornography. It led to him, he got really depressed, and, was even suicidal, was going through some really tough things. His wife, of course she wasn't in our church or anything like that, but she chose to divorce him over it. But the thing that she said to me at one point when I was talking to her about it was that I deserve to be happy. I deserve to be happy. And, I wasn't, in a position, in a relationship with her where I could say, that's actually not what we get promised. But, because we're not promised happy marriages, I wouldn't know. In that case, were I her, an elder or pastor, I would have said that she didn't have grounds for divorce at that point. Because, here's an important aspect of that story is that my coworker, who was genuinely wanting to make amends, was trying to change. He wasn't just sort of like giving up until he really wanted to.
Next question.
In regards to that question, what would you say about abuse? I guess that's a big question.
Yeah. That connects to Jimmy's answer.
Right.
Yeah, that same, again, it depends on how narrow or broad you want to take the idea of adultery, the idea of desertion. Okay? And many times abuse falls under that heading of desertion. They have deserted their vow to honor, protect, cherish. So they've irreparably broken that vow. So, well, the Bible gives two very clear grounds for divorce, adultery and desertion. We've kind of added in there abuse. You've got to be very careful, though, okay? Because I'm convinced that we've had, at our church, a long discussion with the several marriages that are in having difficulties. And so our elders have spent many hours talking about this. We've counseled folks. Our sin wants to make divorce easy. We want to look for any possible out that we can find. And so we will broaden the definition of adultery if we want out of that marriage. We will broaden the definition of desertion. We will look for anything to not fulfill, you know, because we're fallen. And so I think that we have to, you know, look at things more narrow as opposed to broad. So, you know, if someone's undergoing verbal abuse, you know, is that appropriate for them to divorce? I'm not comfortable saying yes, but I understand that's a very difficult situation. It's tricky.
Yeah, I one thing I'd add to that, though, is as an elder, when any kind of abuse is told to me, especially if it's child abuse, I am liable to the authorities to report that. Yeah. So we use the law to protect.
I wasn't even thinking about the abuse of children. There are laws that govern that in all states. I was thinking mainly, you know, physical abuse of primarily from a husband to a wife. That would certainly be able to get them out of that home immediately. But, you know, how you know, we're tempted to broaden the definition of abuse. You know, my husband talks sarcastically to me. He's abusing me. You know, that's probably not what the scriptures intend.
I had a question about like kind of sexual sin. So, is the reason why sexual sin is so powerful and prominent, like in humans, because that sex was king before the fall, and all their sin came after the fall? I mean, because the Apostle Paul makes it very clear that sexual, like he even goes so far as to say that the Lord's will for you that you have given sexual morality. And is that why? Because it's kind of built into us, even when we were perfect, we were still sexual beings.
We talked about this after the session. I've had one more time to think about it. I don't think it's because it was before the fall. I think sex was given to Adam and Eve as, you know, as I said, as this consummation, a sacrament, a symbol of physical symbol of their union that God brought them together and made them man and wife. And it's this deep sort of spiritual, physical connection that also pictures the gospel. So, you know, there's that. When sin entered into the world, sin affected everything God created, and every aspect of creation was colored by sin, and that, if anything, maybe because that was like one of the highest, you know, points of God's creation and what He'd made, how He made us in His image and made man and woman to be able to come together and image Him in that relationship that they have, that the damage, when sin enters into that place, it's that much more, you know, damaging because it was such a crucial and beautiful part of what God created man and woman to be. But I would say that every, you know, it doesn't have to do with the fact that sex was there before the fall. I think it was just the fact that the purpose of the place of sex and the fact that the fall then affects everything. Does anyone else want to take a crack at that?
We're just going to hang you out there.
Right. How would you approach ministering to homosexuals? I have a ton, I'm an artist, I'm in the music world. So I would say about 50 to 60% of my male friends are gay. And a lot of times I don't feel comfortable inviting them to church because I know there are people there who would say really terrible things about them and to them. Do you have any advice on that front?
I can take do a take on this, but I would like to let anybody else start. Yeah, I mean, I've had several friends who are gay as well, and coworkers too. And you know what? I guess the way I've approached it is, I think what you said about being nervous about bringing them into the church because you're afraid of the condemnation that they're going to face in the church is a really valid concern, and it's a shame on our churches that we create an environment where sinners can't come and feel like they belong there because their sin is not any worse than a lot of the other sins that we carry around. And my approach with it, honestly, they need Jesus. After they have Jesus, he can take care of everything else. I mean, I don't believe for a minute that homosexuality is something that you're just born that way. But, I mean, I think that there's maybe some evidence that people can have more of a predisposition to that particular sin than others. I know that conditioning plays a big role in people becoming full-blown, kind of committing themselves to that lifestyle, that there's always a series of choices and things like that that kind of lead to someone choosing that lifestyle. I lost a cousin to AIDS who was a homosexual. But when he got really sick, his gay friends really kind of rejected him, and it was the church that embraced him and brought him back in, and he returned to the Lord before his death.
How many of you have a gay friend? A great book. Some of you have already read it, but go and buy it next week. Rosario Butterfield's Secret Thoughts of an Unlikely Convert. She's now straight, married to a Presbyterian pastor, but she sort of embraced a lesbian lifestyle in her teenage years, was a very brilliant tenured professor at a very liberal university teaching in humanities and gay studies stuff. I mean, she wasn't just like experimenting. I mean, she was full-on bought in,
leading the charge
for LGBT, whatever it is. Is that right? Thank you.
Stuker. Go ahead.
It's her memoir. Okay, so it's not a deeply theological book, but it's her memoir of how she was loved by someone who very much believed that another Presbyterian pastor actually, who believed that homosexuality was a sin that Jesus died for, and she needed to be delivered from, but he loved her, and he received her and welcomed her, and then it was him introducing her to Jesus, and Jesus coming into her life that changed that. But it's a great book. You got to read it. Secret Thoughts of the Converse, Rosario Butterfield.
When Stu Kearns, who's the pastor of Zion PCA up in Lincoln, Nebraska, was here, and he said something that stuck with me. So what's John 3:16? Wow, impressed you have a shirt. What's John 3:17? For God did not send the world to condemn his son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world might be saved through him. And he said, a wonderful elder pastor said to him one time, Stu, God didn't send his own son into the world to condemn the world. He sure as heck didn't send you. Okay.
One more thing I'll add on to the side of that with your question is, I think in those situations and those opportunities, we have to ask ourselves, are we being more driven by fear of man in those scenarios, or trust in the Lord and his goodness and his sovereignty? And the reality is, we have homosexual friends that you're inviting to anything, whether it be a Bible study, there is always a risk and a fear that someone is going to react negatively and bad in a negative way. But in trusting the Lord and also calling upon the fellowship of the church, my hope is that you would have people that you know at your church that you know if they knew what you were doing that particular Sunday, they would rally around and be excited about welcoming and loving and caring for this individual. And so at our church, we call this linking, where it's really, another way, networking, is when you know that if I'm bringing somebody new to the church, I know that I've got 20 people at that church that know who this person I'm bringing in is and the kind of person they are. I talked to them beforehand. And while there may be some folks at your church that would say things behind closed doors or even terribly enough maybe to their face in church, I would hope not. There would also be an army of folks that would come alongside and want to welcome and love. So use the church. Use the fellowship and the goodness of the church to help welcome and care for those individuals, if that's helpful. So.
We only have a limited number of time for this, so I want to make sure we get to these questions that were written down and asked. I'm going to try to read the ones that relate to each other. This first one says, if you know you're going to marry someone or you're engaged, why shouldn't you have sex?
Someone else is going to take that one first.
Okay. Blunt answer would be that God says not to. says the guy who's been talking about grace all week. But I think it's very clear in Scripture that God speaks of sex as something that is between not a engaged man and an engaged woman, but a husband and a wife. And so, that's probably the most off-the-top kind of basic answer, but that's how I'll get that ball rolling.
Can I say, please, sir. Are my kids in here?
Children?
My kids, Billy, they in here?
I don't think so.
He's not one of mine. My kids. I hadn't told them this yet, so. I was convinced at 16 I was going to marry Carrie Wiseman. Convinced. Dated for 2.5 years. We had premarital sex. We broke up my second week of my freshman year of college, right? I mean, you don't know what God has for you. Dated for 2.5 years. So how many, who was talking earlier? You and Tish broke up for a period. That could have been the end of things. You don't know. Thank God that he reconciled your relationship. Kimbo and I, we actually were just a few months from our wedding, and she broke up with me, called off the wedding. Thank God, a year later we got back together. That's another story. But, the question's worded, if you know you're going to marry this person, or even engaged. Hey, engagements get called off all the time, and it creates.
Yeah. Yeah, and what I would say, too, is that you may think you're going to make that promise to that person, you're going to make that commitment to that person, but you have not made it yet.
No.
You have not made it yet. And when you give yourselves physically to each other before you've made that commitment, you have dishonored each other. We talked about this on Monday, this idea that whether you think you've dishonored them or not, you have. And that has been communicated. It has been, it's been done to each other. And the relationship changes after that.
And David and I are talking about this after the guy-girl session. And this is sort of riffing off that high school premarital sex affected my marriage for the first 7 years, nearly half of my marriage, right? So my wife, we were sitting at a youth camp on the beach in Panama City, 6.5 years into our marriage, and I thought that was the end of it, because she was, I was a pastor, youth pastor at the time, and she'd been harboring all of this, wondering if I was comparing her to this other girl that I, had sex with in high school, wondering if a part of my heart was, it's so much crap and baggage that goes with that. Just don't do it. So I will give you a to-do. Don't do it. He can tell you what God's done for you, and I will too, but just don't do it. It's not worth it.
So on top of that as well, sex described in the Bible and also just in the reality of experience is a consummation of a relationship. It is designed to be the consummation, the goal of an emotional, relational union, physical union. And marriage in Scripture is spoken about, again, as whether it's representative of the union of God with his people. And when we put this consummation act before this 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 idea of marriage and a relation. You give covenant bonds to your wife and to your husband, not before your marriage ceremony, but at your marriage ceremony. And you take this consummation of a relationship and you put it before these covenant bonds, you're taking something and you're disordering it. You're disordering it and you're asking for ruin in that. And so that's the only other thing I would add on to that.
Much of the modern-day purity movement seems to tell Christian young people, especially young women, that much of their identity is found in their sexuality, specifically their virginity. Many reputable Christian speakers use analogies such as, a girl who has lost her virginity outside of marriage is like a wilted flower, and no husband would want that. How would you respond to such a statement? If possible, is there a better analogy that is more in line with a grace-based faith?
Good question, Manoa.
I think that that's an awful analogy.
Terrible.
And I think it's unbiblical. We are daughters of the King, and we are sinners. We are not wilted flowers. If you have sex before marriage, it may cause 7 years of hardship in your marriage. It may cause difficulty and ruin. But Christ came to redeem wilted flowers. And we are not that. We are redeemed children of Christ. And not only can Christ redeem a situation like Jeremy was discussing, if we find our identity in our righteousness or in cheap grace, we are not finding our identity in Christ. And so I would say that that's not only not fair or wrong, but it's not the gospel.
Hmm. I mean, David quoted Hosea, right? What does God say to his children, to Israel, which are the same words that applied to Gomer, who went out and whored herself? She's now his beloved. She is, you know, what was broken, the fields the locusts have destroyed, God restores. So it's, you know, there are consequences for sure, but it's not unredeemable. Absolutely.
I mean, just with that, consequences, yes. And hopefully any spiritual leader or mentor you have will be very upfront with you about the consequences of sexual sin, any sin, the supreme consequences that it will have on your life. But hopefully what they will not bring out is the way that it affects your identity. Now, it can affect identity, but it does not change who you are, or most importantly, the way God sees you. So these ideas of a wilted flower, damaged goods, are extremely unhelpful because we see consequences, but we can't let that affect the way that we see our identity in the eyes of God.
And Kimbo, if she were in here, would tell you that the reason it caused so many problems, yes, it was my sin that brought that into the marriage, but it was her complete lack of understanding of God's grace mm-hmm. to her. She didn't understand God's grace for the first 7 years of our marriage. She was converted, sure, but very pharisaical. And I'm not confessing her sin. She would tell you that. So when she began to understand her own sin, it affected how she viewed me as a sinner. Much more forgiving.
That's an extremely pharisaical way to put it. And, you know,
the wilted flower analogy?
What does that mean? You know, it's ridiculous.
And why is it only applied
to girls? Oh, God. Yeah, exactly. I mean, a better analogy is a wasteland that is turned back into a garden. That's the picture that we're given in Hosea. It's the picture that we're given in all through Scripture.
Can I add one thing? There's a passage in Acts chapter 2 that they use the analogy, pastor passes this roll around through the audience, everybody gets to touch it, so on and so forth. The pastor takes the rose back and he says, now who would want this rose? And Chandler's response was, Jesus wants the rose. There's forgiveness in place for all the sexual impurity and sin. We run to him and he wants us. I mean,
mankind is broken, human being who has sinned, that need forgiveness. That's what forgiveness is given. Not just cheaply, but in the midst of humility and honesty and growth.
So if you are a young lady or a young man dating someone who's pressuring you to have sex now, can you break up?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good transition to this.
Yeah.
A couple of years back, I had a Christian boyfriend. He told me that he wanted to get married. He told me that since we would marry after high school, we could have sex and it would still be okay. I was not comfortable with that idea and told him, but he still insisted we have sex. After months of trying, he convinced me to finally one and forced me to lay with him and have sex. Since then, I don't trust men or guys in a relationship, because they'll just take advantage of me like my ex did. I can't bring myself to talk to any guys because I feel I am not sexually pure and nobody would want a broken woman as their wife. Is what I feel normal?
Yeah, I mean, the last question is how I feel normal is kind of a subjective question, but it's, I think, a good sign that you might ask that question because you're obviously dealing with, you know, guilt from the choice that you made. And there's two points I would say. And the first one is, yeah, he was a scoundrel. He was a scoundrel, and that was wrong. That was his sin, and it has nothing to do with other young men in your life. But it is a temptation, I think. But also be careful that you do not blame your own choice on a young man's convincing words, because we are not powerless. And if you are a Christian young woman, you do have the power to go forward and trust other people in your life, because you have the power of the Holy Spirit to make, through him, wise decisions. So you need to make sure that you're not just blaming that decision on a crafty young man that wanted what he wanted. We can become victims in this and say, my boyfriend made me do this, and so therefore all men are evil, and become this victim in our own mind. That's not to say that he was absolutely wrong. But make sure that we understand our own sin when we make those choices, and trust God that he will not only forgive this young man, but yourself. And maybe that's something that you're dealing with is your own guilt in that. Cope with that, come to terms with that, ask forgiveness for that, and then trust that the Lord will bring someone into your life one day that has your best interest at heart, only through the grace of God. And as far as the normal part, I mean, I went through, you know, the same kinds of issues. A lot of girls do experience that, where guys will say crafty things. You know what? Girls also say crafty things. They want what they want. They're selfish beings. They're sinners. Yes, I also went through a period of distrust because I wondered if this guy's trying to talk me into something. That, you know, I totally get it, and I think that that's a very normal feeling. But in a way, in a sense, you are deflecting also your own choice, and don't allow that to damage what Christ may have for you in the future.
I want to add here that I made a lot of physical mistakes in high school. And when I met the man I stood near, I carried a lot of that guilt and shame with me. And I met, and I knew he wanted to marry me. I had to go and tell him what my sin had been and the shame that I carried. And it was the hardest thing I've ever had to do. But he was a man who loved God and knew God's grace. And he heard me and he loved me in spite of it. And he forgave me and we got married. And we've been married for 21 years. Do not ever think that you are unredeemable and that no man could ever love you. Because it's just not true. That's Satan's lie. And it's our society's lie. And don't lie.
I have an easier time getting along with guys than girls, so I usually hang out with guys as a result. I have a lot of guy friends, but not romantic intent. How can I make sure I don't accidentally lead a guy on?
Okay, so David and I were looking at this question beforehand, and I want Annette or Andrea to maybe answer from a female's perspective how they can have guy friendships, but just to be very blunt, you can't. I had lots of girl friendships. They may never have been interested in me romantically, but there wasn't a single one that I didn't think about asking out at some point. Girls, you may think there's this platonic thing going on with you and that guy. I swear, there's a very, very, very good chance that he has thought... has had different thoughts towards you than maybe you've had towards him. Okay?
I think I wasn't 100% on that. I definitely, and we talked about this some on whatever Monday it was, because I do think that guys and girls can have good friendships, but I will also say that almost every time there will be a point where you're kind of asking that question. This is somebody I want
to
ask out.
Well,
isn't a bad thing necessarily,
yeah.
But
to cut you off the past, too, to be blunt, like Jeremy, some of you right now, probably a lot of you actually are saying what I would have been saying in your position. Right, is yeah, but you don't know this relationship. We're different.
Yeah.
No, you're not. No, you're not. I guess
that guy's different.
Yeah. So.
But does that mean you shouldn't have friends with guys, with girls? Or,
yes.
I had a lot of friends with girls. I mean, I wouldn't say that you shouldn't have any friendships. Maybe you got to be honest with each other.
There is such a thing as an appropriate friendship between a guy and a girl that are not dating in high school.
Yeah.
That can't. We're not promoting that you just simply don't talk to the opposite sex.
Single sex education from now.
But obviously, there's balance and appropriate. I would like to hear what these girls have to say about how women can act to not.
Do I need this?
No.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yes. No. I would say that just from a female perspective, that a lot of girls, and we talked about this last night, a lot of girls don't necessarily want a boyfriend, but they want their emotional cup filled by a boy, and so they tend to have these friends that are boys, but they're like we call it an emotional boyfriend. You know, they use these boys they want to talk to this boy instead of going to this girlfriend to confide in because of what they get from the emotional connection that they get, but they don't want to actually go as far to say, that he's my boyfriend kind of thing, because they want several emotional boyfriends. They don't want to just say, he's my boy. So I guess my biggest thing is that I would caution spending alone time with another boy. I think a group setting is the best way to enjoy appropriately a friendship between guys and girls. I guess I really loved what Hope said before about the three T's, talk, time, or what did you say, Hope?
Time, touch, and
talk. Yeah, talk, time, and touch. Not so much the touch one, but even the talk and the time that you're spending. That can certainly give a boy an idea that maybe that's not what you're thinking. And so I would just say, just doing things as a group, be cautious on how much you're emotionally investing. Because I really, I was the type of girl that I hated dating for that very reason, that I couldn't go on a date just as friends. Like, I really didn't think it was possible, because you always get to a point where one or the other likes and the other one doesn't like as much, and then you're not really friends anymore. And so I always I hated it because I would rather just be friends. So anyway, Annette, do you have...
Yeah, no, I would just say it's not really on that, but the other part of the question was, I don't really have a lot of girlfriends. I like hanging out with guys better. And I totally get that. I understand that completely. But I would also ask that you ask yourself, what's at the heart of that? And I am a kind of girl that I don't like a lot of girl drama, and I sometimes think girls are you know, I don't have daughters and I don't have sisters, so I can understand and relate to guys too. But if you're making an excuse, I just can't handle the girl drama, and guys are so much more relatable, and I like to talk about sci-fi and Lord of the Rings, which I also love. But I also have really deep and meaningful girl relationships. So I would say that you need to really maybe evaluate why you don't have girl relationships. Is there something going on in your heart? Do you need a guy validation? Do you feel threatened by other girls? Do you feel a sense of competition? Because, you know, there are a lot of great girls out there that also don't like girl drama and also like Star Wars and Tron and all kinds of stuff. So you are closing yourself down to some great relationships. Girlfriend relationships are important and meaningful, and I and biblical. We need each other to hold each other accountable. So I would just ask yourself, why is that? Why don't I have girlfriends?
Can I just, as I started off, kind of looking, I didn't mean to imply that you can't have relationships, for instance, with the opposite sex. The actual question was worded without leading a guy on. Okay, that is very difficult to do, right? If not impossible. Not because of your intentions, but because of his, right? Or the way that guys are.
Well, and one thing I want to add, and I know, David, we talked about this last night, is that when you get married, the friendships that you have with other boys or other girls, they immediately change forever. Like, they are totally different than they were than when you were friends before you got married, you know? The friendship with your girls, they could be lifelong forever. You know, I mean, those don't necessarily change, you know? And I think the Lord, intended that for us as far as just our mentors that we need, you know, from other women, for women, other men, for boys. I mean, God designed it that way. You know, He didn't design for me to seek out, you know, a mentor and a relationship outside of marriage with a boy just to be my friend to mentor each other. You know, you can be encouragers to one another among fellow believers, but when you get to that point of leading without leading them on, that's where I think you have to reevaluate of, you know, okay, so what is this friendship here? Does that make sense?
You guys watch teenage romantic comedies, don't you? You watch 10 things, everything ends this way, right? Ross and Rachel get married. It always ends this way. Even Hollywood recognizes that. The guy, girls, they hang out, they talk across the window to each other, they grow up next door. That's, what teenage comedy is that? Boy Meets World. Yeah, but even Corey and Topanga end up getting married, right? It always works that way. You know, I'm thinking, what's the one, it had, you know, they grew up next to each other, they're friends, they talk across the window to each other in their homes. Do what?
Every Taylor Swift music video.
Every Taylor Swift music video, yeah. Right? That's the way it works.
Be really upfront with guys and just really tell them. Just say, there's a young lady that even this week said that that's what she does. Like, we're just going to be friends, okay? And of course, you say that, and the guy goes, so you do love me, right?
So you're saying there's a chance.
Guys are dumb. Guys are dumb.
So
you're saying there's a chance. That's how that one in a million talk.
I would say a lot of the rules, sorry, the no list guy just said rules. A lot of the things, the principles that we just talked about also apply to your scenario. And I'd say the only thing that would change is to be a little bit more overt about communicating and being very upfront about what you believe and who you are because of that. And but the example you brought about bringing, you know, a guy to church, which immediately made me kind of go, bringing a guy to church, there's almost like some intimacy to that, like I'm bringing you to the church. But I mean, what you said afterward of like, but like immediately I want this guy to be able to
with other guys.
Connect to other guys. That's great. Whether it's Christian, non-Christian, or Christian, bring them to my youth group, whatever. Making sure they're connected to other guys so that guy can see, oh, she's not bringing me here just to be on her arm. She's bringing me here to get to know her youth group. That helps clarify, I think, a little bit for a guy. So.
All right. Can you address the importance of being equally yoked?
It's important. It's important. Let's pray. No. That's a passage from 2 Corinthians 6, where it says, "Do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers." It says, "What partnership is righteousness with lawlessness? What fellowship with light and darkness? What accord is Christ with Belial? Or what portion does a believer have with an unbeliever?" And I think we can either approach marriage. By the way, this. Most folks look at this passage as informing, especially what it means as a framework for thinking about marriage, okay, and what it means to be yoked in a marriage to a husband and a wife. We have to ask ourselves, are we being informed more by the way that the world talks about what a marriage should be, which is, hey, this is my best friend, and we get along great, which, by the way, are important things for a marriage to have, they don't talk very much about connecting identities. And what I mean by that is if we view our faith as this other thing that goes in our handbag, like, oh yeah, I'm a, you know, extrovert, I like to do this and this, and oh yeah, I'm also a Christian, then yeah, getting married to a non-Christian won't seem like a big deal because it's just one of many things about me. But when we see faith in the way that God has introduced it to us, which is it is a transforming identity marker for who we are, then the question is, how can we share our lives in a union of marriage that has been God-ordained to be a picture of the church and Christ, right? How can we engage in that sort of covenant relationship of marriage that, again, has been introduced as Christ and the church if the person that we are committing to this to has literally no belief or care for Christ? That is an identity transformer for us and literally a non-issue for us. So when it says what portion does a believer share with an unbeliever, well, in a broad sense, there's many things that Christians share with non-Christians. We're humans. We're all a part of God's creation. But what it's getting after there is the core identity of what it means to have your life consumed and filled with Christ and the relationship of Christ to the church. And then saying, I'm the closest relationship of my human life is going to be with someone who literally doesn't believe that's true. What Paul's warning against is that relationship just simply cannot work. And that yoking just simply, it cannot be a yoke. It just can't if those identities aren't shaped. And other guys want to weigh in on that.
Tony,
as well.
Would you broaden that? I mean, you need to have non-Christian friends.
Yeah.
You must have non-Christian friends. You're not being salt and light. You basically adopted a monastic sort of lifestyle if you don't have non-Christian friends. But I think it goes beyond dating, even to your most intimate relationship, friendships. So if your best friend, and your BFF, if they're a non-Christian, that's an issue, right? Because even then in that relationship, your fundamental identity you don't have in common.
Yeah.
Right? So they can only go, that relationship could only go so deep.
Right.
I think one other thing about it is that, you know, ultimately, it's a real, if you feel like this is the person I'm meant to be with, and I know they're not a believer, but this is just, we're so in love, it's like, I mean, you're not trusting the Lord. You're saying, I don't think you have what's best for me. You know, this stuff you said here is clearly not right. I'm just going to make my own path. And that's, you know, that's the same as the rebellion from the garden. It's us wanting to be our own gods. What we're basically saying, I don't believe that you have what's best for me.
Just going off that, then, if you were to like develop feelings for someone that is a non-believer, how would you suggest going about dealing with that?
Well, Jeremy's working on a book about evangelistic dating and how it can be really confusing.
Coming out next fall. No. I'm not answering that one.
flirt to convert. No, do not do that. I'll just say, do not do that. I think it's great. I think it's great to establish, again, in the context that we've spoken of, friendships with non-Christians and even opposite-sex non-Christians. I think that there's an appropriate reality to that being a possibility. But if all the lines, the boundaries and lines we've already drawn in previous answers comes true, or is true, I should say, then there probably even shouldn't be an opportunity for that even conversation to happen if you're drawing the appropriate boundaries and lines. So,
I mean, you may find yourself being pursued by somebody yeah. who really is interested in you who's not a believer, either as a guy or a girl.
Be willing to have hard.
You may have to
be willing to have hard conversations, guys. We're going to have those.
Honestly, just adding on to the non-Christian friend thing, when I was in 8th grade and I was playing my football team, there was this guy who wasn't a Christian, and we were really good friends. We were very good friends for a long time. He didn't know I was a Christian. I never told him. I don't know why. Still kind of ashamed to say I didn't. But in about 10th, 11th grade, he sent me an email saying, wow, this is, I emailed him saying that, like, he asked me a question, and I answered my beliefs and saying I'm a Christian. Finally, I told him, and he said, wow, I've been saved for like 6 months now. How come you never told me? Mm-hmm. He's like, I honestly don't know. He's like, man, I didn't know you're Christian. You play football. I just thought you were just a sheltered homeschooler.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's good encouragement.
Cool. Can I add one thing? I've several of your comments about bringing non-Christians to church or wanting to invite non-Christians to church, and please don't hear when I say what my thoughts are that I'm saying that that's not a good thing. But God has called you. Your friends who are non-believers can see the gospel in you without you necessarily saying, hey, you have to come to church with me to hear the gospel. Okay, because there are some friends that would laugh at you if you asked them to come to church with you. But you live with them at school, and they see Christ in you. And so, I mean, be encouraged that you're ministering sometimes when it's not even a thought that you're ministering. You're showing them Christ. You're being an example to them. You know, Joel and I have talked about this a lot about, you know, our boys play baseball, and we love baseball, but sometimes it does, you know, pull us away from necessarily being able to go to church every single Sunday. So there's, you know, several Sundays where maybe we aren't able to go. But I remind myself that I am surrounded when I go to my kids' baseball games by non-believers. Like, almost every family that we are friends with on my boys' baseball team don't know the Lord. And what an opportunity it is for us to develop a relationship with them, for them to see Christ in our family, instead of me just going, hey, we go to Redeemer Presbyterian Church, we'd love for y'all to come. And that being a source of me ministering. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Does it mean that you don't invite them? But I feel like that maybe the Lord leads you to the point where that's appropriate, you know, because, you know, we go to church because we need to hear the gospel. And, you know, the Lord will prompt your friends to where that's an appropriate time. Does that make sense? But don't feel like that's how a minister is, by inviting them to church. You can do it right where you are, and you are doing that. And be encouraged, you know, don't be discouraged by that.
We've got 5 minutes left. Does anyone have any questions on Tony's talks or Jeremy's seminar?
There's one here. I got one more, Dave.
Good.
One of the lecturers suggested that horizontal conflict can only be restored through vertical reconciliation. Based off that, do you believe it's impossible for non-believers to ever truly have peace? If so, does that mean mental counseling, conflict resolution in a friendship, or repair a relationship between a parent and a child has a 0% probability of working in a non-Christian environment between non-believers?
Who's the lecturer they're talking about? I'm kidding. No, I don't think that that every non-Christian conflict is irreconcilable. Yes, peace, at least some measure of peace, can be achieved, right? Through the common grace of God, grace that he gives to all people, we can experience. My grandparents, my grandfather died 5 years ago recently, and he became a Christian 5 years before that. So he was 70 years old when he became a Christian, right? They were married for 40 plus years and had a wonderful, what I would call, God-honoring marriage, right? But he wasn't a Christian, and I'm not even sure if my grandmother is. So, yes, marriages between non-Christians can work. Relationships between non-Christians can work. But what does Jesus say? My peace I give you. My peace I leave with you. Not as the world offers peace do I offer peace, right? So there's a peace that can only come by being in relationship to God. So non-Christians can know a measure of peace, but they're not going to know divine peace unless they're in relationship with him. And so, yes, you know, if two non-Christians are in conflict, they can apply. You know, a few years ago, I read a lot about conflict resolution and peacemaking and stuff. There's a lot out there that's Christian, and there's a lot out there that's non-Christian, right? Because the corporate world, your parents, if they're in business, they face conflicts with coworkers and clients, and there are all kinds of guys that come in and do mediation training and stuff like that. A lot of that is based on biblical principles, even though it's not Christian, right? Owning up to your fault. They call it a fault, not a sin, right? Owning up to your contribution to the conflict. You know, seeking common ground, these sort of things. So, yeah, non-Christians can take broadly biblical principles and find peace and reconciliation. But I don't think they're going to know full peace and reconciliation apart from Christ. And that would be true in any situation, right? Non-Christians can stay married for their whole life. But it's not going to fully reflect the Christ-Church dynamic apart from him.
Any other questions? Just about time to wrap up. Anything from Paul? He's been up here all.
He's content. These guys are doing a great job.
I'm playing G-Cool.
Just for Paul, regarding the tendencies and the strategy with the each different personality type with the strategy, diplomacy, tactics, and that stuff, can you clarify what each of those sections would mean?
In the notes there?
Yes.
No. I think Dave's actually more familiar with them than I am.
I mean, strategy is big picture ability to kind of.
I resign.
I put that handout together so I can. Depending on your upon your temperament, you're going to have. Be a better leader typically in these different areas of strategic leadership, tactical, logistics, and diplomacy, I think were the four. And the strategy is like you see the big picture. You see not just the battlefield right in front of you, but you see the whole war, you know. And if I can use a war analogy, that would be, you know, Dwight Eisenhower is the, you know, epitome of the NT, right? He's the strategist. Fight, you know, planning and executing World War II, our campaigns, although he learned a lot screwing up early. Tactics, you know, your SP is going to be really strong in tactics, whether it's on the football field or whether it's just in the middle of a situation where you got to be able to kind of read the landscape and figure out what to do right now to be able to, you know, do the right play and win or find the seam. Easy to use football analogies, but that's to stay with World War II. That was Patton, right? He was a nut job, but he was really good on the battlefield. and then you know the people who are more relational are going to have better sense of what's going on. What's this person really want? What's this person really want? How can I kind of bring peace? How can I get people to, you know, see the same things the same way and kind of persuade people and bring people along? That's diplomacy, right? That's what diplomats do. They bring people to the table and they get people to, you know, agree on things. And then logistics is a lot of the details and how do we get, you know, enough of the right stuff to the right place at the right time. Make sure, I mean, everything that Chris has done to help make sure that this camp has run smoothly this week is what we would call logistics. So somebody with SJ temperament's going to tend to be stronger with anything that has to do with kind of keeping things running right, you know, that sort of thing. Does that answer your question? Not in a joking way, but actually just say what I just did. There have been a number of times when I've been in meetings or whatnot and just said, you know what, that's a great question. Let me think about that. Can I get back to you tomorrow? Or can I get back to you in an hour? Or can we come back to that in a half hour at the end of this meeting? So I think there are ways that we can just own up to it and recognize it and bring those, bring kind of that value system or that understanding of the conversation and not try to fake it. I've tried to fake it a lot of times, and it ends up that there's just like jumbled mess coming out of my mouth. And so to actually own that up, say, you know what, I don't really have a great answer for that, or you know, I probably need some more time to think about that. But I'd love to talk more about that later. That's why I said
that. As somebody that doesn't do that, I appreciate when people respond to me that way, because it tells me you actually care enough about answering that question well that you want to really put the intention to. Instead of, we've heard the term word vomit, which is like, blah, and hopefully like something decent comes out. You actually care.
It has its purpose.
It does. You actually care about making a precise and well thought out answer, which means you care about what I ask. So that's, yeah, from the other side, that's another part of it. Mm-hmm.
I just want to make one comment about what Paul was sharing today. As we're talking about evangelism a little bit, reaching people, healing the pain and brokenness of your friends and the people you're around and really authentically grieving with them is, we're talking about a silent witness, not having to ever share the gospel with them. It's one of the most powerful ways.
Let's give a hand to all our speakers this week. Take a 5-minute bathroom break and then come right back in here. If you signed up for the talent show tonight, please come down here for just 1 minute.
Joel.
Yes.